Chapter 38. Manhattan, New York. Midtown. Hemingway Hotel. Wednesday, August 30, 6:57 p.m. Suttabor gave a deep, throaty laugh as she sat up and reached for his groin. "Not again," Joshua Green moaned. "I'm only flesh and blood." "Hush," Sue said. "I've got some ancient Chinese sex techniques I want to show you." Green laughed. "You're about as Chinese as I am English." "Hey, you don't know. Maybe Mom passed along a few things I've been holding back." "Right, let go of that. I mean, I want to talk." "That's not what you wanted a few minutes ago." "I need to recharge, for God's sake, Sue. I'm not some young stud. Let it alone. Tell me what's going on with my records." "Spoil sport." Sue sat back onto the pillows, her breasts rising like tiny mounds. "If we're going to talk, look up here and not at my tits." She reached onto the nightstand and lit a cigarette. "Right." Green pulled the sheet up to cover his growing stomach. He was always self-conscious in the nude, but especially so with Sue, whose body he considered to be perfect. "It's been 3 weeks. We've lost a third of our accounts. I'm getting resignations. We'll be closing our doors at this rate. Can you give me any hope?" She looked at him, then solemnly announced, "I'm pretty sure I can get you up again." Green laughed. "Not that. Although I'd be grateful. But we're screwed if you or this Aiken guy don't come up with something very soon." "Yeah, I know." She sat back and turned serious. "I've tried 3 boots so far, and all were failures. We were struck by viruses with very sophisticated cloaking devices, making them very difficult to remove. The good news is we still have the backups."
"It may be too late," Green said, "given the speed with which the firm is falling apart."
"Josh, I'm really sorry." Sue leaned closer and placed her hand on his chest. "I can't help but blame myself. You've been great not to make my life miserable over this."
Green shrugged. "Aiken says it wasn't your fault. No security system could have stopped the virus. I've not been able to sell that to the partners, but I believe it." He seemed to hesitate.
"There's something else?" Sue asked.
She'd always been impressed with Green's ability to be involved with her while keeping the business aspect of their relationship clear. In her experience, that was quite rare. "It's not important, really." Green smiled weakly, clearly wanting to avoid saying more.
"What's not important?"
Green sighed. "I've been ordered to fire you." Sue looked into his eyes for a moment.
"I see. You thought you'd get your blowjob first, then tell me, you bastard."
Flipping over, she stabbed her cigarette out in the ashtray, then flung the sheet off her.
"No, no, it's not like that.
Well, maybe a little, I guess. It's just, the partners insist I do something. I told them it won't improve a thing to get rid of you, but they don't see it that way."
"So I'm out of a job?" she said, standing beside the bed with her hands braced on her hips.
"I'm not supposed to tell you."
"Oh, I get it. First I fix the problem, then you can me. Is that the plan?"
She sat on the edge of the bed. "Yeah, I'd say it's about it." He reached for her breast. She bumped his hand away with her arm. "What difference does it make? I don't have to do it now, and anyway, it doesn't look like any of us are going to have a job before long."
Sue breathed out. "I guess not." She'd seen this coming, now that she thought about it. What else could the firm do? With the failed third attempt to reboot, she'd understood her job was on a short leash.
"And I'll let you resign. Give you a good reference. You can trust me."
Sue lay back across the bed. "You know what I think?"
"No."
"No more hotel rooms. I like it better in the office."
"Well, that's out of the question."
"Then how about the garage? Or the hood of your BMW?"
"No, no, no, I told you. I've rented this room for the entire month."
"Yeah," she said in mock seriousness. "Who's the boss here?"
"You are."
"Then get down, boy. My turn. And get your car wash for next time."
Chapter 39. Moscow, Russian Federation. Dmitrovsky Administrative District. Wednesday, August 30, 7:02 p.m. Ivana Koskov removed the shichi from the table, then set in place the kurdyak her mother had brought by her office late that afternoon. She emptied the bottle of water into Vladimir's glass, then opened a fresh one before joining him, their heads nearly touching as they ate the rabbit stew. The food brought back pleasant childhood memories, and she wondered again if she shouldn't make more of an effort to learn to cook her mother's dishes. As he ate, Vladimir smoked a cigarette, taking puffs between bites. A smoker herself, Ivana thought nothing of it. On the wall near his computers was a poster of Rick James, with a bulbous afro and bulging biceps. In the background, their stereo had started a random selection of James's songs, including his hit Super Freak. Ivana had long ago grown tired of Rick James, and especially of Super Freak. For Vladimir, it was either feast or famine. He'd go months without his music. Then, in a frenzy, it would be all she'd hear for days. He usually used his headset, so it wasn't so bad. Still, she wished his taste would move on. When they were finished, she cleared the table, wiped it clean, then set out two saucers and cups for coffee. "Vodka?" she asked. Vladimir merely nodded, then wheeled his chair backward and spun it into the bathroom to empty the bladder sack that was tied to the side of his leg. "I think we'll have that new apartment in a few months," Ivana said. "I talked to the manager today, and he all but promised." Vladimir grunted. She heard the water run as he washed his hands. Thank God he was a clean man. Living in clutter was bad enough, if it had been dirty as well. Vladimir returned to his place at the table, then downed a shot, followed by the hot coffee as a chaser. He leaned back, emptied his lungs, then picked up his cigarette. "Maybe I should give Boris a little something to move us up. I'm more than ready to get out of here." Lately he complained endlessly about their cramped quarters. "I don't think anything less than 100 euros would help." "That's okay. Then I'll try it." Ivana was pleased to see his commitment. "I must say the splendor of our first place has worn off." They laughed. "Maybe you could keep this as a storage room for your extra equipment," she suggested, and they laughed again. "It's better suited for that than an apartment," he said with a grin. Ivana smoked quietly, punched out her cigarette. "Do you want to tell me how much you've got? I don't want to start a fight, but it's hard to plan not knowing." His elusiveness and his obsession with his work ate at her. This was the first time she'd been able to broach the subject without his responding with anger. "I've only saved it up as a surprise. It's just over 20,000. "Euros, not dollars?" "Euros." "You have been doing well." She picked up his package of cigarettes and lit another. After inhaling, she released the smoke. "This work you're doing, how long would it last?" "I don't know, not much longer, I think. They seem to be on a deadline, but I don't know what it is." "What is it you're doing?" For months now, Ivana had been certain he was working for the Russian mafia again. She had feared for their safety, and his surly manner of late hadn't helped a bit. "It would bore you. Tell me anyway." Vladimir hesitated, then explained about the rootkits, growing excited as he did. "They hide things in computers?" she asked when he stopped. "That's it. There are simple ones and complex ones. I've been building more complex ones every week. It's really intriguing work." "And you aren't doing this for the mafia?" Vladimir laughed heartily. "Those people? Of course not. It's out of Europe, I think." "Where?" "I'm not certain. They're very secretive. I'd say France, but maybe Belgium. My contact writes English like a Frenchman sometimes." "Or Quebec? Or North Africa? Don't they speak French there, too?" "Sure, but they don't have any money." "But he could be anywhere. I'd have to spend a day tracking back one of his messages, and even then it might not work. I don't care anyway. His money is good." She sipped her vodka. "What?" A dark expression had crossed her face. You're telling me the truth, aren't you?" Vladimir stared at her for a long moment, the anger starting to well up. He pushed it down savagely, then, in a steady voice, said, "I've told you what I'm doing. I'm not lying, Ivana." "Good. Then we are safe and I can breathe again." It seemed to her, in that moment, that the life for them she dreamed of would actually happen. She'd have a baby, and everything would be perfect. Chapter 40. JFK International Airport, New York City, Thursday, August 31, 3:37 p.m. Brian Manfield rolled one of the dice in the palm of his hand. 4. He went to the fourth taxi in the queue and asked the driver if he spoke English. The Pakistani nodded his head. "Say a few words if you would, mate," Manfield asked, "just to be sure." "Yes, I speak good English." The accent was thick, but Manfield understood him. "Right then, load my luggage." The other drivers ahead had exited their vehicles and were agitated, vigorously complaining that he hadn't taken the first taxi. But Manfield ignored them. The driver shot back a quick answer that satisfied no one as he moved to open the trunk. Manfield waited on the curb, discreetly scanning the area as the driver placed the luggage into the trunk, then climbed into the taxi as soon as the Pakistani did. He gave the name of the modest hotel where he'd be staying as the car pulled away from the curb and drove out of JFK International Airport. They drove through Queens and Brooklyn in silence, then crossed the Manhattan Bridge onto the island. The going was slow after that, but before 5 o'clock, Manfield was checked into his hotel. He showered, changed into running shoes, tan chinos, a polo shirt, and a dark blue windbreaker. The day had been crisp enough, he thought, that he wouldn't draw any attention, especially at night, with the jacket. Outside, he took in the city, realizing how much it reminded him of portions of London. He entered the subway, exiting at Inwood, where he walked 4 blocks. The address turned out to be a small store. The aging sign outside belonged to the former owner and read, Swenson's Sporting Goods. A bell over the door sounded as Manfield entered. A dark-skinned man in his mid-30s behind the counter looked up. "We are just closing, sir." He was slender with a well-trimmed beard. On the surface, the accent was British, but Manfield recognized it at once as Egyptian. "I won't be long," he said pleasantly. "Perhaps you have a package for me?" The man took another look at his customer. "I don't understand." "Omar said you were holding something for me." Manfield always felt silly with these games, but at least once in the past they had saved his life. The man blinked, then replied steadily. "You mean my cousin Mohammed? Perhaps you're right, though now I recall his name is Abdul." "Allah Akbar," the clerk said quietly. "Just a moment." He retreated behind a curtained doorway, while Manfield moved closer to the front door, where he could watch equally the rear of the store and the street. A moment later, the man returned with a package wrapped in heavy brown paper tied with twine. "Here." Manfield hefted the package and nodded. "Thank you." He turned and went out the doorway without another word. 2 blocks away, he entered the McDonald's he'd spotted earlier and pressed his way through the crowd to the men's room. He waited nearly 5 minutes until the handicapped stall was free, then entered and secured the door. Inside, he spread several layers of paper across the seat, then sat and carefully opened the package. Inside was a cell phone, which he unwrapped and placed into his left front jacket pocket. The small envelope he slipped into the inside pocket of the jacket. Next, he opened the dark plastic rectangular box. Inside was a Boker ceramic lock blade knife with a titanium handle and a drop-forged 2-inch blade. It was small enough to pass as a simple pocket knife any man might carry. He snapped the blade open with just his right hand, closed it, and snapped it open again. Perfect. Closing it, he slipped the knife into his right front pants pocket. Also in the box was a .380 Astra Constable, the Spanish version of the better-known Walther PPK. Made without alloys, the weapon was surprisingly heavy for its small size, a characteristic Manfield approved of as it meant less recoil. He removed the pistol, checked it for balance, confirmed it was empty, then dry-snapped the hammer 3 times to test the trigger pull in double action. Smooth and light. Someone who knew his business had reworked the trigger. Beside the pistol was a 6-inch-long silencer, the size of a roll of half-dollar coins. He placed it into his left front jacket pocket, beside the cell phone. 2 empty metal magazines were also in the box, along with a supply of Remington 102-grain Golden Saber hollow-point ammunition he'd requested. It had the best spread characteristics of all .380 ammunition, and was the most lethal. Manfield slipped bullets into each clip, filling them to capacity. Placing one in his right jacket pocket, he inserted the other into the butt of the pistol. He worked the slide once, releasing it to feed a bullet into the chamber with a sharp snap. He lowered the hammer, then removed the magazine, and replaced the bullet now in the weapon, then placed the magazine back into the gun. Confirming that the safety was off, so the weapon was ready for immediate use, he inserted the pistol inside his pants at the small of his back. Next, he rewrapped the box, tied the package with string, then unlocked the door, delivering the stall to a 10-year-old boy dancing on his feet. Manfield smiled. "All yours." He buried the package in the wastebasket so it didn't show, then left the McDonald's, glancing at his watch as he did. 6:13. He walked steadily back to the subway, confident he still had plenty of time. Chapter 41. Manhattan, New York City. Fisherman Platt and Cohen. Thursday, August 31, 9:08 p.m. When Sue Tabor was 16 years old, she'd lost her virginity to a summer boyfriend in a small park not far from Chinatown in San Francisco. She'd been visiting her grandmother and had decided this would be her best opportunity. She knew no one there, so no one would talk about her back home in Roseville. Leaving soon for college, she refused to be the only virgin freshman there. In college, Sue had learned discretion and the advantages of sustained relationships over one-night stands. When she'd moved into her career, she discovered the value of sleeping up. She couldn't care less what her co-workers thought. She liked to screw, she'd once told a girlfriend, so why not screw someone who could do her some good? In her world of computers, attractive women were rare, so she'd had little competition. And she had no complaints. Joshua Green was a case in point. Though nearly 30 years her senior, he'd proven a surprisingly robust and satisfying lover. Separated from his wife of 25 years, a separation for which Sue refused to hold herself responsible, he turned to his young IT manager with a fierce ardor. The more she'd insisted on sex at the office, the more passionate he'd become. Sue had learned early on that sex with a young woman, especially one with exotic looks, was quite enough for most middle-aged men. But if she threw in a few things their wives had long ago stopped doing and added a bit of excitement, they were hers, much harder to get rid of than to keep. She'd been about to land her next substantial pay raise when this super freak bug had struck, ending all prospects. Green had promised to find her a good job elsewhere regardless of the outcome, but she knew word about what had happened would spread, and there would be some hesitation in hiring her. Managers would wonder if she couldn't have done something to prevent the contamination, or at least fix it sooner. The most intriguing part of the last 2.5 weeks had been Jeff Aiken. She'd never pressed enough to move beyond their professional relationship, but couldn't help wondering what it would have been like had she done so. For a man so knowledgeable with computers, he was surprisingly fit and handsome. She'd seen a flicker of interest, but he'd taken it no further. Not that there'd been an opportunity. Green had spotted her interest from the first and dropped by several times a day. She didn't want to risk that job recommendation in the event this turned into a disaster. People were going to ask why Fisherman Platt and Cohen had gone out of business, and her name was bound to come up. Anyway, there was plenty of time. She had Jeff's card, and lots of other fish were in the sea. It had been a difficult day. She'd made copies of the partially cleansed copies she'd twice tried to boot and had Jeff step her through what he knew about Super Freak, explaining to her the methodology he was following. She'd spent the last 3 days reworking the copy of the last daily backup, searching for signs of the virus, but she decided it was largely a waste of time. She just didn't know enough. She'd only tried because there'd been no other productive work for her. Sue had checked her email and found her Super Freak posting had generated more than 100 messages, but none that helped her, and none from Super Freak himself. The man was apparently Russian, as Jeff had surmised, and was a sort of Greek god when it came to viruses. She'd asked questions of some of those who'd emailed her, but in the end it turned out no one really knew all that much about Super Freak, except that he appeared in certain chat rooms from time to time. She spent days in those rooms, but he'd not reappeared. She'd posted a few more messages for him to contact her with no positive results. Dante had been equally elusive, and Sue feared that her first message had driven the men underground. Harold left the office at 6:30 while Sue was returning to the backup. 2 hours later, Green entered the IT center, coming up behind her, then cupping her breasts with each hand. "Guess who?" "I don't have to guess," she'd said. "No one handles me like you do. What's up?" "Handles? Is that what you call it?" "What else? They aren't doorknobs." "Sorry," he said in a little boy voice. Men can be such children, she thought. "Now don't get that way. I didn't say I didn't like it." Sue stood up and put her arms around him. They kissed. "Like I said, what's up?"
"Me, for one. You about done here?"
"I think we're about done permanently."
"That bad?" She sighed.
"I don't know. Jeff's pretty discouraged. Looks like we got hit twice by the mother of all viruses."
"Shit."
He looked as if all the steam in him had vanished. "You can say that again. I'm almost finished for the day."
Me too. How about the Hemingway in an hour?
Sue nodded. Pick up some Chinese, will you? I'm starving.
Sure.
Green gave her that hound dog look of need. She patted his arm.
Later. And don't start without me.
20 minutes later, she was ready to leave. She decided to polish her resume the next day and would tell Harold to do the same thing. Maybe Jeff would come up with a miracle, but she wasn't banking on it. As she left the offices, several associates were hard at work. These cases had recently been started. All of the files had been in their laptops when the firm had been struck. They shot her unpleasant looks as she passed by. She guessed a few of them had sent out their resumes already. Outside, Sue breathed in the night air as she glanced at her watch. Green would be waiting. She stepped off sprightly, walking 3 quick blocks before stopping just outside the hotel to remove the keycard and take a mint from her purse. As Sue placed the candy into her mouth, she felt a sharp pain against her right ribs.
So make a sound, or I'll cut you.
The voice was British. Over here. In the alleyway, she braced herself.
Take my purse. I don't have much.
Shut up. Let's go to your room. Act like we know each other, the clerks at the desk.
What do you want?
The knife went deeper into her, enough to cause a wave of nausea to sweep through her.
I said shut up.
Don't speak again. And remember, we're friends. Manfield's information had included her driver's license photograph. He'd waited nearly 3 hours for Sue to exit the office building. He'd followed the woman, assuming she was on her way home. In the event he was mistaken, he had her address. When she'd stopped almost in front of the hotel and removed a plastic keycard, he'd realized she wasn't going home just yet. Since she lived in the city, he concluded she was meeting a lover. He couldn't risk her spending the night, so he'd had no choice but to take her. He wanted this job over with.
Chapter 42.
Manhattan, New York. Hotel Luxor. East 30th Street. Thursday, August 31, 9:31 p.m. Jeff ate as he watched cable news. No mention of the super freak virus, but he was bound to get into the media eventually. He wasn't convinced that would be bad. Getting the public involved sometimes had a way of speeding up patches. He opened the IQC, saw Daryl was online, and typed, JA33, is there any plan to leak to the media? There was a short pause. D007, hello to you too. I hadn't given it any thought. What do you think? JA33, we aren't making enough headway. I can't see any harm. What do you think? D007, unless I go off reservation, it won't be my call. The security vendors know about it already. At some point, I think one of them would issue a press release. JA33, I was just thinking we could get more resources to bear if the public was involved. Plus, it would put heat on the vendors. Are they cooperating yet? D007, it's still pretty low on the totem pole so far. I keep trying. Rootkits mean many viruses aren't detected. JA33, any new developments I should know about? D007. More BIOS wipes, primarily Dell and HP. They turn the machines into anchor weights. JA33. How about chat rooms? D007. Super freak name something but no help. I don't have enough staff to do as much as I'd like. JA33. Have you posted my messages to Super Freak? D007. We talked about that and decided against it. It would alert him. He'd change his pattern. No one knows much about the guy. We found some posts for Super Freak from outside. JA33.
Who?
D007. Someone using the name Dragon Lady. Mean anything to you?
Dragon Lady? Someone Chinese?
JA33. Could be almost anybody, but this isn't common knowledge yet. The IT manager at the firm is part Chinese, but she didn't say anything about posting. What do you think?
D007. I'd say Super Freak has been tipped off already.
If she hasn't told you anything, it's 'cause she didn't learn anything. Jeff made a mental note to talk to Sue about it in the morning. D007. New York City tomorrow. We'll call to meet with you if okay. JA33. Sounds good. Anything else? D007. I think we're screwed.
Chapter 43.
Manhattan, New York, Midtown. Hemingway Hotel, Thursday, August 31, 10:19 p.m. The Hemingway Hotel had undergone a complete restoration in the 1970s, a time of considerable labor strife in the Big Apple. As a result, much of the work had been shoddy. The hotel had been sold twice since then, and it was a chore to keep the place looking good. The latest owners were contemplating whether another remodeling would be better than repairing as necessary. While they dithered, certain necessary improvements had never taken place, such as the installation of security cameras. There was no clerk, no one at all at the front desk as they walked stiffly through the lobby to the elevator bank. Sue punched number 4, unable to think of anything else to do, or anything at all to say. In the elevator, she began to sweat profusely, droplets running from her armpits. Stepping off the elevator, Manfield and Sue Tabor moved down the hallway toward room 416. At the doorway, they stopped and he whispered into her ear, "Open it right now, Sue." She'd never been more frightened in her life. That he knew her name, that this wasn't a random act, terrified her. The pain of the knife was dulled by a thick layer of fear. Sue slipped the keycard into the slot and pulled it up sharply. When the light switched green, the man turned the handle. In they went, in a quick rush. Green had removed his jacket, shirt, and undershirt, and he was standing by the bed wearing only his trousers, looking toward the television set. "What the—" he stammered. Manfield pushed Sue into Green so hard, the pair fell back against the bed. Drawing his pistol, Manfield said, "Quiet now. If I have to make any noise, I'll kill you both. Tell me what I want to know, and nobody gets hurt." Gesturing with the gun, he motioned for them to sit. They sat on the edge of the bed. "If you want money," Green said, attempting to take charge of the situation, "I've got—" "Shut up. Plenty right there on the desk." Green stopped and stared at the barrel of the gun, the energy draining out of him. Manfield moved slowly to the desk and glanced down. With his free hand, he pocketed the cash without counting it. "Who are you?" he said to the man. "Joshua Green. What are you to her?" "Why, yes, I can see that." "He's my boss," Sue said, understanding what the Brit wanted to know. "Ah, I get the picture." "Better and better. Sue, lie in the bed face down. Pile the pillows over your head, and don't move. You," Manfield indicated Green, "come over here." Green hesitated, looking at Sue for an anguished moment. "Now." Sue lay across the bed, rolled uneasily onto her stomach, and crawled up the bed, inching her way slowly. She pulled the pillows to her, then piled them over her head, feeling very young. "How does he know my name?" she thought. "What does it mean?" From a distant childhood memory, she found a prayer and began to say it to herself. Green rose, then crossed to Manfield. "Over there," Manfield said, indicating the floor in the corner. Green walked slowly, like a man condemned, as if each step was one of the last he'd ever take. When Green's back was turned, Manfield put the automatic away and brought out the knife, snapping it open one-handed. "I have a few questions. I'm sure you'll tell me what I want to know." On the bed, Sue made a small sound, perhaps a sob, muffled by the pillows. Week 4. Rootkits proliferating at disturbing rate, by Arnie Willoughby, Internet News Service, September 1. Nearly one quarter of all malware located in the Windows operating system is found to be stealth rootkits. This is the result of a recent survey by an alliance of cybersecurity companies. "Rootkits are the fastest-growing segment of malware," said Arliss Scarborough, the alliance director. "Rootkits are generally not detected by existing antivirus software. They implant themselves deep within the kernel of the operating system. Infection rates are reportedly increasing by 100% each month, and at this rate, rootkits will soon represent the majority of malware present in computers. Rootkits can be used to cloak any type of virus and make it very difficult to detect and remove the malware. This is an especially disturbing evolution in cybersecurity," said Scarborough, who advocated increased financing for rootkit detection software. Internet News Service Incorporated, all rights reserved. Chapter 44. Manhattan, New York City, Central Park, Friday, September 1, 10:05 a.m. Just north of the pond, Jeff and Daryl sat at a picnic table. He placed her portion of the ravioli in front of her, along with the plastic utensils, as she set down their coffee and two unopened bottles of water. Jeff peeled the top from his coffee and blew steam from the hot brew as Daryl took her first taste. "Mmm, good," she said. "I was getting sick of bagels and rolls all the time." Jeff nodded in agreement. He'd felt the same way, which is why he'd suggested the impromptu picnic. Watching Daryl relish her first bite, he felt pleased with himself for remembering that both of them were more than the sum of their work, even though in the back of his mind, he'd hoped that fresh surroundings might inspire fresh insights. They ate and sipped coffee in silence for a few moments longer. Then Daryl said, "Do you think our dragon lady is your IT manager? I'm curious myself. I'll know in a bit. I haven't been in touch with her since we messaged last night. Let me know anything she's learned." Jeff nodded as he took a bite. He glanced up and his eyes fell on a couple spreading a blanket in the morning sun. The air was cooler, but still more summer than fall. Scattered about were other couples and individuals out walking, talking on cell phones, listening to iPods, tossing frisbees. He wondered for a moment how different their lives would be in 2 weeks if he and Daryl failed. Would the machinery of this great city grind to a halt? Would the power grid collapse? He could scarcely imagine every catastrophe that was possible. Returning his attention to Daryl, Jeff asked, "Why are you back in the city?" He'd been idly wondering about that since hearing from her. "I thought you had an important government agency to run." "I'm following up on something here." Putting down her fork, she added, "And I wanted to see you." Realizing how that sounded, she tacked on, "For a reason." "Other than my good looks, you mean?" Jeff said, with a grin before realizing he was actually flirting with her. He'd always found women so complicated, far more complex than the most difficult computer problem. Even gentle Cynthia had thrown him for a loop every so often. But Daryl, he was finding, wasn't all that difficult. Her mind worked very much like his did, and she was no more geared toward failure than he was. They were on the exact same wavelength in his view. He was completely comfortable with her. Sure, she was drop-dead gorgeous, but since she didn't make much of her looks, Jeff realized he hadn't either. Now, though, with the sun highlighting her golden blonde hair and a smidgen of tomato sauce accentuating her full lips, her beauty was hard to ignore. She smiled. "That, too, but there's something we need to do that you won't want to do." "So you figured you'd pitch it to my face?" He pushed aside his unexpectedly amorous train of thought, wondering what she was up to. Daryl hesitated, and for a moment Jeff felt a chill as the warm feeling he'd had vanished. "Fly to D.C. and meet with George Carlton. I'll go with you," she added hastily, taking that moment to touch him briefly on the arm. Jeff felt a tight grip on his throat. "You're not serious, are you?" His voice sounded foreign even to him. Daryl pursed her lips. "I am." She leaned forward and spoke quietly. "Nearly all the triggers are date-related, and we're 10 days out from the event, and we've got zilch. I've sent so many messages, made so many calls, cornered so many people. I've worn out my welcome. There is nowhere else I can go at this point, so it has to be him. Carlton is the chief of counter-cyberterrorism at DHS. If he wants to, he can wield a lot of clout. I'm being ignored, and the security vendors are way behind the curve on this one. If he can get even one of them moving, we can spare a lot of people a lot of damage." Jeff's face turned rigid. "There's nothing I can say to him that you can't." The very thought of seeing Carlton face to face caused Jeff's bile to rise, and he's not going to listen to me. We've a track record in that regard, you'll recall. "I know you don't believe this, but I think George respects your work," Daryl argued, looking intent. "I've sensed it in how he's mentioned your name the time or two it came up. I personally think he feels badly about not listening to you." Jeff gritted his teeth as he spoke, trying to hold back his anger. "Feels badly? He damn well should. A lot of people died because of him." "Maybe. But things were so bad in those days. I doubt he could have stopped what happened. Really, Jeff, he was your boss, but only a very small fish at the CIA. His superiors would have still been studying your report when the planes flew into the towers." Jeff raised his voice. "We don't know what would have happened. He could have told someone, at least. He could have done more. At the very least, he could have tried." Daryl looked around to see if anyone was paying attention to them, then turned back to the conversation. We all could have done more, except maybe you. But we have to focus on the here and now. You've seen this virus firsthand in far greater detail than I have. Between the two of us, maybe we can get him at least to lean on the vendors. They're the ones with the resources to counter this. Determined to get Jeff to see her point, Daryl refused to back off. She was desperate and willing to do just about anything to get him to join her in what she saw as their last hope. "Excuse me." Jeff rose and made his way to the nearby public men's room. Inside, he scrubbed his face with cold water, fighting back the tears. Pulling out a handful of paper towels from the dispenser, he rubbed his face nearly raw. He stood quietly and drew several deep breaths, releasing them slowly. "Who am I really mad at?" he thought. "Carlton or myself?" The answer still wasn't clear to him. After nearly 10 minutes, he returned to the table. "There's this," Daryl said, as if he'd never left. "My team has determined that the super freak virus propagation avoids IP addresses owned by software security vendors. Think about that, and the effort that's gone into creating it. It's also one of the reasons why the vendors aren't giving this priority." Jeff's voice was steady as he said, "I agree, someone's put a lot of thought into this. There's more." She was speaking so quietly he almost couldn't hear her over the background buzz of conversation and traffic. "It only targets U.S. and European computers." Jeff was stunned. "The rest of the world is excluded?" "Yes." Daryl bit her lower lip and seemed to struggle for self-control. "My God," Jeff whispered almost to himself. "They're after the West then, not just the technology. It really is an attack." There was nothing left to discuss. "You win, I'll go." "Good." She pushed the remainder of her food away. "We're on the noon shuttle flight, and are meeting him at 3.
Chapter 45. Paris, France. Saint-Quémy arrondissement. Graffismal Corajou, Friday, September 1, 12:05 p.m. Gaullist protesters marching in opposition to Arab immigration had all but closed the routes into central Paris. Labib had decided it was pointless to try to drive to his office. He'd called to tell his secretary he wouldn't be in. Most of the staff, she told him, had done the same thing. Labib dressed casually, left his car parked outside his house, then took a taxi as far as he could into central Paris. Once he reached the closed streets, he began walking, staying off the main arteries, clogged with demonstrators. It was a beautiful late summer day. The morning air was invigorating, though he knew the city would by afternoon be sitting in a stifling heat. Weaving his way down side streets and alleys, he reached the back entrance to Graffismal Corajou nearly 2 hours after leaving his house, where he found Michel Dufour hard at work. Dufour nodded as Labib entered. "The front staff never arrived." "The French, I'll never understand them. Where are we?" "Just a moment, let me finish this." Dufour continued typing as Labib dug a bottle of water out of the small refrigerator they kept in the office. He sat at his desk and waited. Finally, Dufour stopped, turned toward him and said, "Do you want an overview of the attack?" Labib nodded. "I've kept a rough count and believe we have dispatched more than 2,000 variations of our Corps Boîtier. I'm launching something like 5 to 10 a day, and we'll keep sending them out through the 10th. A significant number are self-replicating, and that increases the numbers considerably." This was even better than Labib had dared to hope. "In addition," Dufour continued, "I've paid to have the new attacks of old Boîtiers increased. The purpose is to keep the security companies too busy to pay attention to ours. About 2 weeks ago, we launched a Boîtier that blocks automatic updates." "Is it working?" "As you know, we can't be certain, but my sense is that it is." "What else?" "As for our own Boîtier, I've been spending more effort to have them encrypted and compressed. Some variants are encrypted with the activation time or codes that will be automatically published on compromised websites. That makes them much more difficult to decipher and should buy us enough time. I wish I'd thought of it sooner, like the Noirs. I wish every Boîtier had one. What is done is done." The reality of the cyber jihad had never reached the level of Labib's dreams or expectations. As he had once described it to Fajr, it would ideally have been unleashed on an unsuspecting West, along with a major Al-Qaeda attack against physical infrastructure or targets with symbolic value. But that had proved impossible to coordinate. The lost years had not proven all bad, though.
More and more Westerners were going online, depending on their home computers and the Internet to conduct business and banking. Over those years, more and more banks had turned to electronic banking, since it greatly reduced their costs and increased their profits. In theory, a bank of the 21st century had no need for a physical office and needed precious few real employees. The profits of such an operation would be enormous, and banks throughout the United States and Europe were racing one another to be the first. Computers and the Internet were one of the primary means for the expansion of Western culture and were instrumental to its military and economic dominance in the world. They were the means of the most powerful attack on Islam, perverting and tempting Muslims everywhere, launched since the days of the Prophet. Those who said Muslim extremists would never destroy an Internet they too relied on for communication and the spread of propaganda didn't understand what was at stake. The Internet would be rebuilt in time, but in the meanwhile, the inflicted damage would be incalculable. The military of the West depended more and more on computers and the connectivity of the Internet, as did Western civilian governments. In the United States, nearly every government function was tied to the Internet. Social Security and the Fed, to name just two, could be accessed from the Internet. The list was almost endless, which was why Labib had elected to take a shotgun approach, rather than to target specific organizations. He'd ordered a series of viruses crafted that could potentially infect every computer in America and every function tied to the Internet. He was trusting that technology would plant the electronic seed of his jihad everywhere. The objective was to infect and destroy as much of the information and technology of the West as possible, all on the same day. When Labib had finally devised the cyber attack, separating what he could actually accomplish from fantasy, he had flown by helicopter at Nebu Fajr high in the Hejaz Mountains at the remote camp of members of their tribe. They had consumed a traditional Arab meal consisting of al-kabsa, rice cooked with chicken in a pot, dates, hawayij, a spice-blended bread, followed by al-haisa, a sweet dessert, while watching traditional dance performed by the unmarried young women and girls of the tribe. Fajr had pointed out one of the girls, about 10 years old, a fragile beauty with doe-like eyes and a luminescent face. "My future wife," he said. "I will keep her here, so she is not contaminated by luxury." Labib thought the idea of raising a wife to form was disgusting, but said nothing. Though the Prophet allowed four wives, Labib knew from personal experience that the consequences for all were not necessarily good, and thought his brother knew this as well. Labib loved his wife, and would never take another. Late that night, as the camp settled into the evening, amid the smells of smoke and camel dung, mixed with the sweet fragrance of cedar native to the region, the brothers sat by a dying fire, as Labib told Fajr what the two of them would do for Allah. "We will launch our cyber jihad in coordination with an Al-Qaeda attack that will make the World Trade Center seem as nothing. We will destroy billions of dollars in assets, cripple the Internet on which the Western world depends, unleash floods, shut down, even destroy power plants, including nuclear ones. Airplanes will fall from the sky. Millions of computers will be permanently destroyed, including those containing the records of pensions. The loss of key data will be incalculable. Faith will be shattered. Anger against their government will be greater than ever before. It will cause more damage than the first attack did. The West, the United States of America, will suffer a great defeat. Faith in Western technology will be crippled. In the Muslim world, those who have been mesmerized by false prophets will turn away, while our true brothers, who have been tempted by the West for too long, will rise up. In Iraq, Iran, and Syria, those fighting the infidel will be emboldened. It will take years to recover from this, years of retreat for the West. It will end with a new caliphate." Fajr's eyes had blazed with fervor, and Labib had never felt closer to him or to Allah. But now he knew some of what he had planned would not happen. There would be no Al-Qaeda attack, and he could not estimate in advance the full extent of the harm he would cause on September 11. He was certain it would be substantial. It might even be crippling. Yet this was only to be the first attack. Already he and Dufour were planning a follow-up, which they would unleash before the United States had recovered from the first. Their assault from this time forward would be relentless and unstoppable. The rear door opened, and Fajr stepped in, neatly dressed in a dark charcoal Armani suit. Labib had had no idea his brother was in Paris. He grinned and stood up, taking his older brother into his arms. "Assalamu alaikum." Fajir smiled. Assalam. He released his younger brother and greeted Dufour. How goes it? He asked in French.
Excellent, I believe. We are in Allah's hands, the young man answered.
Good.
Fajir found a seat. He could not remember when last he had felt so confident, so certain.
Earlier that week, he'd alerted George Carlton to look for any government knowledge of or concern over the name Superfreak, spelled with a PH. He'd received no alert and was feeling better about the security of the jihad.
Infidels will already die for Allah, Fajir smiled warmly, and many, many more will soon follow.
Chapter 46 Department of Homeland Security, Washington, D.C., Division of Counter-Cyber-Terrorism, Friday, September 1, 3:14 p.m. As soon as he returned to his office, George Carlton regretted the half-bottle of red wine he'd indulged in over a late lunch, when he realized whom he was about to meet. He popped a breath mint and willed himself to be more alert. In the years since 9/11, Carlton had experienced no guilt over his decision to sit on Jeff Aiken's report. He'd always considered it too lurid and imprecise to have had any impact on his superiors. It would only have raised questions about the kind of operation he ran in those days, and nothing would have happened in response to it anyway. Look at that FBI agent in Phoenix. They'd ignored his repeated reports about Arabs learning to fly commercial airplanes, but not wanting to practice takeoffs or landings. He'd been lucky not to get fired. Only after he was at DHS did Carlton retrieve the report one afternoon and read it in detail for the first time since he'd received it. He'd been chilled by its prescience. In detail, it had contained many inaccuracies, though it was difficult to say that the suggested targets hadn't actually been intended, just not carried out. Of particular note was that Jeff had identified the operation as Al-Qaeda. To think that 9/11 would have been thwarted if the CIA and the FBI had actually acted on the report was fantasy. They had had other information just as reliable, and from sources better known to them, Carlton knew, and had done absolutely nothing. Passing the report up would have been pointless. And of course, once the attack actually took place, making certain no one who mattered knew about Jeff's report had been vital to Carlton's continued career. Jeff had assisted him in that regard by resigning, rather than going to his superiors. Not that his superiors would have wanted to know such a report even existed. Carlton was sure there had been others. The company was, after all, a big operation, and its primary mission was gathering information, and they'd all vanished as quickly as had Jeff's. No, all in all, Carlton felt no guilt over his actions. The federal bureaucracy was what it was. He'd have been a fool to have done other than what he'd done, which didn't make this meeting any easier. He knew Jeff had lost his fiancée in the towers, and he'd dealt with him enough in the aftermath to know how emotional he was on the subject. But he liked seeing Daryl, and welcomed almost any opportunity to meet with her. In fact, the more seriously he considered divorce, the more often he found his fantasies turning to the Scandinavian beauty. Carlton smiled at the couple waiting for him, and extended his hand. "So good to see you, Daryl. You're lovely as ever, and Jeff, what can I say? It's been too long." Daryl rose and shook Carlton's hand while Jeff ignored the offer. Carlton looked at Daryl as if to say he understood. "This way, please. Can I get you anything?" Carlton's corner office was spacious and elegantly appointed. His recent improvement in fortune had let him indulge himself a bit. The Persian carpet was a case in point. He'd spent $30,000 on it, though he told staff it was a gift from his wife, who everyone assumed was rich. But it had the effect on visitors he'd sought and had become a symbol to him of the life he soon expected to be enjoying. Just through his door, Carlton hesitated, thinking about holding the meeting from behind his enormous desk. He decided to use the small, intimate, in-office conference table instead. "Nothing, then?" he said as they took chairs around the table. Daryl was stunning as always, dressed today in a trim business suit with a brightly colored floral scarf at her neck, which set off her skin tone to perfection. Jeff, as always, was dressed in tan chinos, Rockports, a polo shirt, and a navy travel blazer. He looked much older than the last time Carlton had seen him. Carlton wondered if time had been as hard on himself. "I'm all ears," Carlton said, beaming at Daryl.
"I'll get right to it, then," Daryl said. "Time is valuable, and we both appreciate your agreeing to meet on such short notice. On August 11th, CISU estimates several hundred computers nationwide were immobilized by various types of malware. There were a number of deaths. You recall the auto worker and hospital deaths I spoke to you about 2 weeks ago?
I do.
Carlton assumed his serious demeanor. There were more than one dozen others, all in hospitals. I sent you a list of the activities adversely affected.
Yes, some accounting records, software in hospitals, air traffic control problems in New Mexico, I think, and some dams.
Are those the ones you mean?
Jeff felt his skin crawl from merely being in Carlton's presence. Coming here was a mistake.
Darrell nodded to Carlton, and it was Arizona, though that's not important. My team has been following up, and we have a much better picture of what took place. I've asked Jeff to come because he's the most knowledgeable on the Super Freak virus. It caused the computers...
Excuse me?
Super Freak?
A jolt such as he'd never experienced before shot through Carlton's body.
That's right. Does that mean something to you?
Carlton struggled to regain his composure, then shook his head.
We've concluded that most, perhaps all of these viruses, Darrell continued, were at least in part the creation of a hacker with the cyber handle of Super Freak. So that's what we're calling all of them. It's in the report I filed with you last week.
A report you never read, Jeff thought.
Carlton smiled and nodded. He struggled to focus on what he was hearing, but could not. In his head, all he could hear was a sound like the crashing of enormous waves.
Proceed, please, he managed to say.
Darrell looked at him oddly. Jeff knows Super Freak better than anyone, and I'll ask him to tell you about it in a moment, but for now my team has been able to identify 478 separate attacks by Super Freak, all occurring on August 11th. We have reports of hundreds more that could be related, but we're not including them unless they're identical in operation or the word Super Freak has been found.
None since August 11th. That's encouraging, Carlton said hopefully.
I'm afraid not, Jeff heard himself say. It's the opposite, in fact. For an instant, he wanted to strike the man.
It sounds as if the danger is past, Carlton countered. If I'm not correct, you're describing a date-activated virus.
Darrell said yes. But in nearly every case, we've determined that the date in some part of the affected computers was off by 1 month. They actually read September 11th.
For a moment, Carlton felt no sensation at all in his body. It was as if he were being prepped for an operation, and the anesthesia had been released into his bloodstream. Only the day before, he'd planted in Fort DuPont Park a copy of Darrell's latest report, which he hadn't bothered to read.
Darrell was still speaking. That all the infected computers are to be triggered on that date. We've drawn the obvious conclusion, but have no proof. We've been focused on learning about it, deciding its scope, and persuading the vendors to act.
Carlton cleared his throat.
If I recall correctly, you believe this is a Russian hacker interested in financial gain?
Not quite, Jeff corrected.
In fact, we found no hint of a desire for financial gain. Financial and other records are targeted, but the effect is destruction, not theft. And Russians are well known to hire out to all comers.
He stared at Carlton to make certain he'd made his point. This was meaningless, but he'd promised.
I learned from Darrell just this morning that Super Freak is programmed to avoid the IP addresses of security vendors and is only targeting U.S. and European computers. The viruses are also employing very sophisticated rootkits. I've been working nearly 3 weeks on Super Freak, and I still don't have a handle on it. In my case, the computers were affected with two viruses, one cloaked, both very destructive. One was meant to erase all data, the other to destroy the operating system. The second succeeded before the first was finished, but I haven't been able to rid the system of the viruses.
We need signatures and patches, Darrell said. To get them, we need the vendors to take this threat seriously.
They aren't cooperating?
Carlton raised his eyebrow.
Not particularly. Their honeypots haven't turned it up because it's ignoring them, and the rootkits are hiding them from detection on their customer systems.
Darrell paused and looked closely at Carlton to be sure he understood the significance of what she was saying. In a firm voice, she said, I need you to lean on them.
I don't know how much influence I can have if U.S. CERT is having no effect.
It can't hurt, George, and we haven't much time.
What about other agencies, the FBI?
Darrell nodded. The increase in computer-related incidents hasn't gone unnoticed. I understand a report was placed on the president's desk 2 days ago. He's referred the matter to the FBI and asked for a detailed report next month.
That's it, then, Carlton said.
It's not enough, George. This is all happening so fast there isn't time for this kind of leisure in responding.
Clearly, they don't understand the extent of this thing, or the president would not have asked for a report. He'd have demanded action.
You know how this works. We all do. They'll want to prove everything is connected and not random. They'll require solid evidence, not indicators. They'll be more concerned with covering their backs than with dealing with this hot potato. And the FBI is hardly the right agency to deal with this kind of threat.
Who is, in your opinion?
The Division of Counter-Cyber-Terrorism. That's you, George. That's why we're here.
Carlton was sweating now. He licked his upper lip. For long seconds, he remained motionless. All he could think was, super freak.
Jeff leaned forward. You're not going to sit on this, too, are you?
Darrow looked sharply at him, but Jeff paid no attention to her. His eyes focused on Carlton like lasers.
Carlton drew himself up. I've never sat on anything important, despite what you think, Jeff.
Jeff laughed, the sound coming out more like a sharp bark.
You make me sick. I gave you the World Trade Center towers as targets, the Pentagon, for God's sake. I gave you the names of five of the hijackers, and you did nothing.
Carlton seemed to recoil.
It's true, but you gave me a lot of unrelated information as well.
But that's not the point. I passed the report up. I can't be held responsible if no one believed you.
Jeff shot to his feet. You son of a bitch!
Darrow stood up, taking control.
Jeff! Leave this room now. I'll take care of this from here.
Jeff stood immobile, then abruptly turned away and walked stiffly out the door.
Carlton leaned back, removed a handkerchief, and wiped his brow.
Thank you. I thought he was going to assault me.
But he didn't, she said. Are you all right?
Carlton drew a deep breath, still staring at the closed door, then slowly released it.
Yes. You see how emotional he can be, though.
I don't want his anger to temper my message, Darrow warned. I need for you to lean on the security vendors to get as much of the government moving on this as possible.
You think it's that serious?
Carlton struggled to regain some composure. He was finding it impossible to get his mind on track.
I think in 11 days, we're going to wish to God we'd done something more. You can be absolutely certain people are going to ask questions. At the least, we need to show that we did everything we could.
Yes, yes.
Carlton hurried to reassure her.
I understand and agree. I'll see to it at once, today, in fact.
Thank you.
Darrow gazed at Carlton, who'd behaved oddly for most of this meeting, and wondered if she could trust him.
I'm going to see to Jeff now. He's in no state to be left alone.
She rose. I guess I asked too much bringing him here. I apologize for that outburst.
It's all right. I respect how he feels. I just wish he could see my position.
A grateful Darrow shook Carlton's hand, then left his office. For once, he didn't check out her ass the minute she turned her back to him.
Carlton staggered over to his desk. His mind was whirling. How could I be so stupid, he thought.
Frantic, he replayed his last conversation with Fajir.
He had to act, had to do something.
Jeff wasn't outside Carlton's office or in the lobby. Instead, Darrow found him leaning against her car in the parking lot, staring in disbelief at his BlackBerry.
Are you all right? She asked.
Jeff looked up at her, stunned.
I just received a message from the IT manager's assistant at the law firm in New York. Sue Tabor was found murdered this morning. She was in a hotel room with the firm's managing partner. They'd both been tortured.
Chapter 47. Manhattan, New York, Hotel Luxor, East 30th Street, Friday, September 1, 5:33 p.m. Brian Manfield spent the day in two different movie theaters. He'd found them to be as safe a refuge as there was when on a mission. Movie theaters were dark with a large room to disappear in. They also had several exits. The police would have to be certain the man they wanted was inside to cover them all. And he liked American hot dogs. He'd been told the very best were sold at baseball games, but he'd never attended one. He found it difficult to believe any could be better than those he'd enjoyed that day. Manfield's mind had not been on any of the movies that played across the screen, though. Instead, he'd relived the experiences of the previous night. Extracting the information from them had not been difficult. Threat alone had been sufficient to learn everything they knew. Once satisfied, he'd slit both their throats before taking a shower. They were long dead as he dressed, making certain no blood was on his clothes. The hallway had been clear when he'd left the room, and there was no security camera to avoid. A clerk had been at the front desk, but Manfield had turned his face and was on the street within a moment. He finished his third hot dog of the day and wondered what they put in them. They had to be unhealthy, but he didn't care.
Wonderful.
He glanced at his watch. It was time. Outside, the city was beginning to slow from the bustle of the day. He walked 8 blocks to the Hotel Luxor, glad to stretch and get the exercise.
then positioned himself in the shadows of the alley across the street, checking first to make certain he had the alley to himself. Removing the pistol, he screwed the silencer onto it, then slipped it into his right jacket pocket. He had a good description, but it could apply to any number of men. He'd need to be certain first. From here, he could cover both directions to the hotel. He hoped the man would be back soon. There was much to do, and, as always, little time in which to do it.